One sec, I'll be right back, guys.
How do I get to the Goodreads group? I don't remember.
Here, I'll post the link in the Google Hangout.
Post your link in the Google Hangout.
Whoa, Renee. Not on the air.
Yeah, on the air that can totally be edited.
Don't edit this, Sander.
Leave it there, Zimzam.
This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. With me this week are two amazing people, Renee Rodriguez.
Ayo.
And Nick White.
Hey. Less enthusiasm than the AO, but like I can't force it, so I'm sorry.
That's okay. You know, I'm super excited that you're both here, but before we start the show, I want to remind everyone that our Kickstarter is still running. We've got some amazing stretch goals that we're trying to reach because we just got funded. So if you want to hear some how we make the show episodes, some drunk on comic episodes, if you want to get free pins, we've got pins coming, people. Go to ircbpodcast.com/KS2017 and back it. Get a t-shirt, get a sticker, get something. Anyone who backs a physical reward, and we hit that, I think, $800 or $900 mark, everyone who's backing a physical reward will get a pin. It's going to be super duper cool. So go do that right now because we're going to go to Emerald City Comic Con and it's going to be amazing. So I want you guys to get as much stuff from us so that we can give you more content. It's a whole thing. But anyways, onto the show. This week we're here to talk about comic books as per usual. So let me ask the question that I ask every single week. How have you been? How have comic books been? Let's start with you, Nick.
I've been good. I've been busy. Thankfully, the weather around here in Michigan has given me ample opportunities to stay indoors. I'm sure Renee can back this, but we had practically about 3 days last week of just utter nonstop rain.
Forever. I think we're starting to hit that here in New York.
Yeah, maybe you guys have got what we had, but it gave me plenty of opportunities to get some reading done, and then I've also been busy. Yesterday it was like Halloween Comics Day, which I guess public service announcement, if you didn't know that was a thing, you get to wait 364 days. Congratulations. Good news, it's right around the corner. So, next year, when you're not making mistakes, go to your local comic book store, and they will probably have some free issues for you. So I got a Hellboy in the BPRD, 1953, first nice. Issue of Baby Teeth, first issue of the second season of Sabrina, which I think is technically seven. I don't know, like seven.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, which was interesting. Some interesting picks. A few things I kind of already had, but when you're a comic book reader, you've already become very comfortable with the idea of hoarding things you may or may not need, or you already have seven of. So, no sweat off my back. One weird tendency, though, I've seen this a lot. I saw it with my copy of Black Eye Kids, I think, from last year's Halloween thing. What is it with them publishing books in black and white that, like, otherwise don't have a black and white edition? Is it just because it's cheaper, or is it because it's supposed to be spooky? I don't know.
I think it's both. I think they're trying to like hit two birds with one stone.
Yeah, spend, you know, less. And honestly, give the, yeah.
Honestly. I mean, exactly. all my favorite stories are in black and white.
It's not in color.
The Walking Dead is the scariest book out there. No, yeah. I'm kidding.
It will never die.
You think about it, Night of the Living Dead, it's all in black and white, you know. Mm-hmm. Some of the great classic horror movies of our time are in black and white, so maybe that's the idea.
All the great mangas are in black and white, just saying.
Yeah. And they're all spooky, right, Renee?
I mean, no, but if you want to
sometimes they're spooky for reasons you don't quite understand.
That is the truest statement I have ever heard in my life.
Oh man. But yeah,
so what have you been reading, Nick?
That was a good experience. Sort of in the Halloween vein, I read Batman Aliens, which was published in 1997. Featured Ron Mars on writing, who has sort of a veteran writer, been around forever. Right up there with Dan Slott in terms of antagonizing people on Twitter, the people who deserve it, I should be clear about that, and a few who don't, maybe. Mm-hmm. And Bernie, the late great Bernie Wrightson on art, for those unaware, Bernie co-created Swamp Thing with Len Wein. Both of them died earlier this year, within like 3 months of each other. Really, really weird. But that happened, so there's a little morbid trivia for you. Really, really good book. Normally, obviously, when you read something that's like 20 years old, you try to gauge your expectations for what the art's going to look like. Because for better or for worse, or, you know, how good or how bad the artist is, sometimes it's just unavoidable that, you know, production techniques will take control and just make things not look great. But this was fantastic. I guess I shouldn't be surprised that someone that spent a large amount of their career drawing Swamp Thing would have a pretty good command over drawing foliage and landscapes, but surprise. And he also has a really good command over drawing xenomorphs. So pretty enjoyable. Very sort of like flimsy what-if premise. Bruce Wayne hires a geologist who works for Wayne Tech to go and investigate some like mine or something that's supposed to be rich in minerals, blah, 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 blah. Guy goes missing, and Batman takes it upon himself to go find the guy. And of course, when he does, he runs into a group of like mercenaries that are part of some black ops organization that they won't say what they're doing, they won't say why they're there, but of course they're going in the same direction Batman is. So you know, it's the usual bunch, you know, the single woman who's trying to prove that she can be one of the guys, the Bible thumper guy who's, you know, quoting verses left and right, you know, as the alien chops off his head. You know, you got the squirrely, weaselly tech dude who hides all the time and, you know, meets his, you know, end. And then, of course, there's the sudden but inevitable betrayal. So, like I said, it's got all of the, you know, required, you know, you can check off all the boxes on your aliens checklist. But really enjoyable, sort of dumb fun. For the record, there's about an 8-page sequence of Batman wrestling an alligator or a crocodile, whichever one is in South America. If both are there, I don't fucking know. Let's just say it was a crocodile, okay?
Sure.
But it's great. It's a great sequence, and the mercenary guys want to kill it, and Batman's like, "Don't kill this. I work for the World Wildlife Fund." He doesn't say that, but that would have been around at the time, because, you know, they shared their name with the WWF before that became a lawsuit. And and he says, you know, it's just doing what's in its nature, which of course is just a natural precursor to, you know, the whole alien premise of, you know, they're just doing what they're
foreshadowing, Nick.
Yeah, yeah, you know, they're gonna do what they are gonna do, and it's the humans that are the real baddies. So enjoyable, a lot of fun. What else? Well, let's go over a few more things here. I read Mr. Miracle number 2. I realized number 3 is out, but I didn't have my books for 3 weeks, so I read number 2. I actually like number 2 better than number 1.
That's okay.
Okay. I didn't know. I didn't know what other people were thinking about it, but I thought 2 was better. I realize it's a little less new reader friendly. There are a couple deep cuts, a couple character reappearances from Kirby's run, a couple Easter eggs and references back to Kirby's run. But I like that this book continues to keep saying to the reader, like, who are you trusting? Like, who do you put your trust in? Who do you think is telling you the truth in this story? Because certainly issue number 2 tries to upend everything you know, who you should trust. But for me, like, I took that and I took it one step further and said, even if you take this paradigm and you flip it on its head and you say everything you knew was wrong, I still believe on some level, what if this entire construct, flipped or not, is still all being made up by Scott Free? So I think that's a really interesting part about the book. Yeah. I worry it's going to get progressively less reader-friendly, new reader-friendly, but who knows? I guess I've got number 3 sitting around. So if you guys want to wait right now, I'll go get it. I can read it over the air if that's fine. Okay. All right. I'm all about options.
I'm totally a new reader in this regard, right? Yeah. I know nothing about Mr. Miracle, and I don't feel like I'm being put off, because just like, I feel like a lot of other King's work and a lot of other books that have these big, like, character-focused, character-study-type stories, you can't really expect, whether or not you know the character, that everything is as you expect it to be in another type of comic book. Like, for instance, I mean, to harken back to the one that started this whole shebang in the current generation, if you think about Hawkeye as a book, reading that book, no matter how much you knew about Hawkeye, you could not have You could not have sat around and said, this is new reader friendly or not, because regardless, it was such a focused tiny story that it doesn't matter who you are, whether you know Hawkeye or not, you can jump in. And I feel like Mr. Miracle's the same way. If you roll with the idea that this is just some weird sci-fi thing, if you didn't know Mr. Miracle was a character, then this book totally works as a new book. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I'd agree with that.
I was just gonna say, honestly, I don't know anything about Mr. Miracle. I thought he was a robot until like a couple months ago.
Same.
That's fair. That's because he definitely does not have a real, you know, definitively humanoid appearance, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Like, I knew who he was. Like, I knew that he existed, but I thought he was just like the DC's version of Vision.
Well, what doesn't help is kind of looks like Red Tornado, which is sort of DC's version of Vision. At least that's the closest counterpart I can come up with. So I can totally see where things get a little bit muddy. Beyond that, let's see. I read Green Arrow 29. This continues to be that whole Green Arrow teaming up with different DC characters. Ben Percy writing, Juan Ferreira on art. This issue, he teams up with Batman, which Juan Ferreira does not get to draw Batman enough, honest to God. It's a beautiful, beautiful issue. You sort of have a butting of heads between Green Arrow and his real bleeding heart, and Batman being a little bit more reasoned in his approach. And I like that this book continues to wear its heart on its sleeve. It's not afraid to be political. It's not afraid to be topical. As the phrase goes, it's not afraid to speak truth to power. And what I love about this book is that for all the people out there that are saying, oh, Green Arrow, look, it's gone the way of Marvel books, and it's trying to be really topical and controversial, People think Green Arrow has gone this way. Absolutely.
Okay.
It's like,
I'm not the person that would even know. I don't know why I asked that question.
Sure.
As if I would know one way or the other.
Yeah. Mike, get on the inside track of like Green Arrow message board discussions, and then you'll be there. It's a real niche group of shitheads. I'm kidding. You're all wonderful people. Probably not all of you. Anyway, yeah. The funny thing is that Green Arrow's always been like this. Like, that's the funniest part about it. Like, Green Arrow has always wanted to talk about controversial issues, from crony capitalism to drug addiction. The list goes on. It's always been about these sorts of things. And so, for anyone to say this book is inching closer and closer to that, good. That's what it's always been. So. You know.
Yeah, DC can only have one Batman.
Yeah, right? DC can only rock the boat with one book, okay? Yeah, there can only be one wealthy, straight white male in the DC universe, although technically Green Arrow had his bank accounts emptied. So he's always having his bank accounts emptied. He's basically the Scrooge Duck.
Anyways.
Yeah.
We're falling down the rabbit hole, Nick. What?
Sorry, Green Arrow gets me all excited.
Don't you mean falling down the quiver?
Oh, get out, Renee. Thank you for being on this podcast. We'll catch you next time.
Yeah, Renee, like, it's a pun, and you use arrow terminology, but I don't... Nope.
Someone will appreciate it.
Maybe those guys on the message boards will. I think they'll probably enjoy it. One last thing. Nick, did you read anything new? Yes, I did read Bloodshot Salvation number 2. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, do I have a lot of thoughts about this book, but I'll really just boil it down to this. We have figured out now that Jesse is capable of inheriting the Bloodshot powers from Ray without him dying.
Oh, snap.
So the idea that in the future he's still alive, it's possible. But what's interesting is that Magic and Jesse get rescued from their attack by Rapture, which we all sort of, not Rapture, Rampage, we figured was going to happen. And it's the other Bloodshots, the World War II one, the Vietnam one, the Russian Cold War one. And she's like, well, who sent you? And they're like, Ray did. And she's like, he's dead. And they're like, yeah, we know. So mystery afoot. Ray's off in the present day to go deal with Magic's evil, terrible dad who runs a cult in Ohio. So, just for those keeping score, Bloodshot lives in Michigan, so that's great. And the bad, evil people live in Ohio. So, for college football fans, these are not foreign ideas. Anyone who lives around this area, like, already believes this, so Jeff Lemire is getting in on it, boys and girls.
Yeah.
But that's what I've read, so.
Cool. Renee, what have you been reading lately, man?
I figured you'd like that Ohio reference, Renee.
I really did. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me collect myself.
Big college
here.
Football people here.
Yeah.
Nick and Renee.
Mike,
not
especially.
Me. Not
like,
me. Sorry.
Like, there's like me, and then there's Renee, and then if you go like 87 stories up into the air, like, that's where Mike is in terms of like college football fandom. He's miles ahead.
Yeah, I remember one time I asked Mike and Brian about, like, I was like, did you guys see the game? And they both looked at me, and then Brian just went, yeah. Sports.
It was, yeah, Renee. So the, it was, you it say was good. That it's like you're just like, did you see that ludicrous display last night? Like, that's exactly like what you said to us, but it was about American football.
Yeah, yeah, and but still, like every single time I try to bring up sports, you guys just give me this doe-eyed, just like, yeah, okay.
We're the wrong group, man. Sorry, I'm sorry. I wish I had this love for college sports
just,
you do.
You know, public it's okay. PSA. It's okay to be a geek or a nerd and be into sports. And pro tip.
It's totally
if
true.
If you are a geek or a nerd and you're not into sports and you want to try to relate with people on a superficial level, it's sports. Start learning. If you want to learn how to interact with other people, this is how you do it.
This actually leads directly into what I read this week, actually.
I'm so excited. I knew that. This is what you're going to do. I'm so happy.
So, what I read this week, Robot X Laserbeam, which, if you don't know, is a manga about golf. It's a sport.
I'm so excited to read this manga.
What an ever-loving fuck. I was about to say, Renee, none of those things are sports. Go on.
I know. Technically, I hate golf. I don't think golf is a sport. It's more of like a skill.
You ever played Mario Golf? You love golf.
No. I'm not getting into this with you. We're focusing on the comics.
Yes. What is Robot X Laserbeam? How was the most recent chapter that you read?
Okay, so the most recent chapter, actually chapters, really ballsy, because Robot X Laserbeam, like I said, is a sports manga about golf. It's absolutely ridiculous, and it's wonderful, and I love it. But chapter 31 this week is what came out. But at the end of chapter 30, like, they just did like a first like full match or whatever in the series, and you're just kind of like seeing, okay, this is what it's going to be like. I get it. I'm getting into the rhythm. I'm going to get sit down and get ready for like four more arcs of this. But yeah. No. The writer, Tadatoshi Fujimaki, who is a ballsy, ballsy man, he just goes, yeah, we're not going to do any of that high school stuff. 3 years later, we're doing a time skip at chapter 30.
Oh, snap.
That's a ballsy move. For anyone that doesn't know about manga, you don't do time skips until you're at least like in the 200s.
Manga don't skip high school. That's an essential, like, living, breathing part of like manga, right? Isn't that like how...
I mean,
it's like, a staple.
It depends on the series, but I mean, yeah, slice of life is pretty important. But still, a time skip is huge. You don't do a time skip until you're like in your 200s or 300s. To do one at chapter 30 is a ballsy, ballsy move. And I was really worried about it and what it was going to do. And chapter 31, really basically nothing happened, but it was absolutely hilarious. And I couldn't even begin to explain it because there's too many things that you need to know. But I laughed so hard that everyone in my house was just like, what is wrong with you? Are you on drugs? And I was just like, I'm sorry. It was just, it's so funny. But Robot X Laserbeam, absolutely fantastic. So good. And I really enjoyed it. I'm never going to tell you guys all the manga that I read because then we'd just be here for forever.
Yeah, that's fine.
So I
thought you were
going to,
like, I thought you were getting at, like, there were certain ones that, like, no one should know that you've actually consumed, but okay.
Oh, I mean, like, there's definitely ones that I am uncomfortable, that I have been uncomfortable reading and telling people about.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm never, like, if someone's like, have you read this? I'm never ashamed to be like, oh, no, I've never read that. I don't know what you're
right.
talking about.
What's that?
I'm saying I've never...
It's okay. Yeah. Get to the next thing. This opening sequence is taking so much time, you guys.
It's Nick's fault.
Yeah, I'm not gonna defer that. No, I'll take that.
Anyways, One Piece was great this week. The latest chapter of One Piece just goes to prove why One Piece has been the king of shonen manga for over a decade because it's always consistently amazing, and this was just another reason why. If you don't read One Piece, I just got to say you're missing out, but at the same time, I can't tell you to just go and read it all because it's huge.
Right. 883 chapters are out now, you said?
Yeah, we're almost at 900 chapters. So, I mean, to tell someone to go read One Piece, that's a very daunting task. That's like saying read everything of Batman. Everything.
Everything,
but
yeah.
The thing is, One Piece is it's super good. It's super amazing. If you're reading One Piece or if you have read it before and you stopped, get back into it because it only gets better. It's so good. And the last thing I read this week, because we were reading Long Halloween and it was Halloween, I just had to reread Bedlam Volume 1, which is written by Nick Spencer with fantastic art by Riley Rossmo and the outstanding colors by Jean-Paul Suka, I believe is his name.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, I love this book. And especially because there's controversy right now about the Batman White Knight book, which shows, you know, like a rehabilitated Joker, like sort of helping Gotham out while Batman's insane.
Yeah.
Bedlam, and I know Mike knows this, I don't know if Dick knows this, but Bedlam is about a
supervillain
called Matter Red, who is essentially like the Joker, who gets rehabilitated and then put back out into the world. But since murder is all he knows, he decides to help the cops.
Yeah.
The only thing is,
and of
no
course,
one knows,
there's the... Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No one knows that he's this villain, that he's Matter Red. And it's so fantastic. It's so fantastically creepy. Like, it rubs me the wrong way in all the right ways. And I'm
it's rubbing the lotion on the skin, let me tell you.
Yeah.
It's so fantastic. I absolutely love rereading it over and over again, and I wish more people knew about this book. Especially since, it hasn't had a volume 3, and I don't know if we'll ever get one. So everyone pick it up and, you know, just, you know, politely beg Nick Spencer to write volume 3.
Don't read that book in public either. Do not read that book in public.
Yeah.
Oh, God, no.
The imagery is, oh, my goodness. I think you forgot to mention one of the big details, though, Renee, which is he doesn't even know that he's Matter Red, right? And things, except
no,
things
knows.
Start to crack.
Not completely.
In his,
not...
Right, isn't it like bits? Is he starting to remember it, right? Things sort of form cracks.
No, he's sort of flashing back to it because he's fully aware. He's fully aware.
Really?
Like, there's a scene where he's fully aware that he did, because he was like, no, I did bad things. He's like, and I don't want to do them anymore. And he even, like, sometimes, even, like, there's a hot second in Volume 1 where he's talking to a detective, and she's commenting about something, and he says, I am not well, which is something that he said as the villain.
Matter
and
Red,
he says it in the same. He says it in the same voice, and the detective, who was in the room at that time, was like, what did you just say? And he's like, oh, I did bad things. But no, he's fully aware that he was. Because at the end of Volume 1, he also does a big reveal that he's clearly aware. Because you're sort of not sure
most
of it in the first volume. But at the end, he's like, no, I totally know that it's me. But I know that what I did was wrong. I'm trying to do good. But all I know is murder. So,
Bedlam is insane, and I remember there was some controversy around it, if only because I remember, like, Rossmo didn't want to continue to do the work because it was really messed up, and I think...
Ryan Brown took over.
Ryan Brown came in and took over for Volume 2, and then even after that, it was kind of like Nick Spencer kind of blew up and did other stuff, on top of now him being, you know, the bad boy over at Marvel that no one likes, I guess.
I was going to say, if he wants the court controversy, go do it over at Image, where at least they'll give you a big, you know, paycheck along with, you know, all of the crazy headlines on Bleeding Cool, so...
Right. Well, for me, this past week, I read a couple things. I didn't read a lot. Just been kind of feeling off reading comics for some reason, but I did sit down and read a few things. I read the Batman Elmer Fudd special that came out a while ago. I picked that up in the crazy DC crossover sale that they did, and I was like, why the hell not? I heard so many good things about it, and this book was absolutely stupid and amazing at the same time. As someone who watched a lot of Looney Tunes as a kid, it's perfect, and I think Tom King totally nailed his super gritty Batman storytelling with... and paired it with a very over-the-top concept without making it overtly over-the-top. that's all I'll really say about it. Tom King, Brian Vaughns, and Lee Weeks on arts, because there was also a backup story in the end that was very classic Looney Tunes, which I appreciated as well. I also read Sacrifice. This was a Comixology submit book that I picked up. I saw the cover and fell in love with it. It's this beautifully drawn skull on the cover. I think it's like a 99-cent book. It's only 19 pages. This is by Ken Lowry and Kevin Warren. The overall TLDR of this is, don't be a tourist in a sacred land. Don't take what some people consider sacred and use it as your entertainment. And there's a lot to be said about it. I thought that the twist was kind of weird and it ended really abruptly. But like a good horror story, that actually worked really well for this. At the end, it's spooky. And you kind of, it's got this ominous ending, and I really enjoyed that. The art by Kevin Warren was top notch. I think his line work is absolutely phenomenal. This is a really cool little just story. So if you've got a buck and you want to try something that you maybe wouldn't have seen otherwise, jump on Comixology and grab this book. It's called Sacrifice. Otherwise, yeah, I read Punisher number 17. This is the last issue by Becky Cloonan and Matt Horak. This is a fantastic ending to an amazing run. 17 issues of solid Punisher action with a one big story arc and a few little one-shot Punisher issues in the middle where Punisher's just killing bad guys. And that is so satisfying sometimes. You just need to see a dude who's hard on justice and hard on killing people who deserve it. It feels really good. Despite the moral quandary that they may bring up, you know, as we read other superhero books, the Punisher, they did some really solid work in this book, and I really enjoyed it. So, good show. I liked that the final panel and the final cover was Frank Castle walking out in a tux, as if to say goodbye to everyone in a very formal setting. So, it's such a solid book. I think this is going to be one of those nice hardcover, like, omnibuses or, like, you know, complete run stories books that you can put on your shelf and be happy to have. Plus, you've got Steve Dillon at the beginning, and I think Matt Horak did a great job transitioning into the new art style. And Becky Cloonan is just a stellar writer. I don't know what else to say about that. Finally, I did read a book called Buzz from Oni Press. This is by Ananth Panagaria, I want to say. I may be pronouncing that wrong, and I feel bad. I apologize if I am. But with art by Tessa Stone, this book is basically a manga, but it's self-contained, and it's like 200 pages. It's fucking beautiful. The art is so top-notch. Like, Tessa Stone, I want to read everything that she's ever drawn, because holy shit, her art is amazing. The story of this book is, what if in this world, spelling bees were like gladiatorial fights? Where every word you'd spell turned into a sword or a shield or a laser beam, or it would allow you to fly and beat people up. It's so cool. Such a cool concept. This book is called Buzz. The story's a little clunky. There's some weird panel work where the dialogue bubbles kind of like ran around a little bit, and I had to reread a page or two. But overall, this book was great. I loved it. I could not stop reading. I picked it up and could not stop. I bought this at FlameCon earlier this year at Tessa Stone's booth because I thought the color work she did, which is this vibrant yellow on black and white, looked really, really good. And I was like, sure, this sounds really, really cool. And I fucking loved her art when I saw it. And so, yeah, I read this from beginning to end in one go, and it's so good. Such a fun book, and such a goofy concept. The end is it just, you know, wraps itself up nice and clean with a bow. But man, what a fun concept. Spelling bees as gladiatorial fights. That's like the only way I can think to describe it. So yeah, go pick this up from Oni Press. It's called Buzz. I can't say it enough. I'm gonna sell the hell out of this. One thing I didn't actually write down, just a quick mention, I read the first two chapters of an online webcomic called Barbarous, which you can read over at johnnywander.com. This is also by Ananth Panagiara. And yeah, I like this guy's work. I didn't realize that it was written by the same person until I'd finished Buzz, that holy shit, this is the same person. Barbarous is a really weird slice of life book. And I say weird in that there's so many questions that I have. It's a world with magic and people who have glamours and people who have magical powers, and they live in this apartment building. It's a really fun webcomic, and the fact that you can go read it all for free, like a very, like a professional grade, top-notch, something you could read over at Boom or Oni or Image, available online for free, is really, really cool. So go over to johnnywander.com and check out Barbarous. So anyways, let's move on. Let's talk about comics that are coming out this upcoming week. November 1st, comic books will be dropping. What are you guys excited for? Let's start with you, Renee.
My Hero Academia.
That's it?
Dude.
No explanation? Just like, that's what's happening.
Like, everyone should know what that is.
I'm conflicted because I know that, Mike, you're reading it and you're behind. So I don't want to spoil anything, but it's on like Donkey Kong, man. It's so on. This arc, like the last couple arcs have been really kind of slow, and like I felt like My Hero Academia had lost its electricity or whatever, despite the fact that it's still been selling really well. I haven't been that into it. And then,
Renee, what is My Hero Academia for people who may not know?
It's like Japanese X-Men, basically, yes. Except that superheroes are accepted everywhere instead of hated. So, yeah. But like, basically, it follows a young kid who wants to be the world's greatest hero, and he actually, you know, meets the greatest hero, and he gets started to be mentored by him, and the world's fantastic, and all the powers are great, and it's amazing. The art's fantastic. The whole thing, all of it, is great. If you're not reading My Hero Academia, get your life together.
Yeah, it's easily one of the best manga I've read ever. And I, not to say I haven't read a lot, but I would say that I've read some good and bad shonen manga, and I think this is some of the best shonen manga that's available right now.
Yeah, and like I said, it felt a little bit slow for the last couple chapters. That is up until about maybe 5 chapters ago, something like that. So like the last month has been really. Really, it's been an emotional train wreck, really, the past 5 chapters.
Mm-hmm.
But it's... I will say this. They're fighting against the Yakuza and their captains that are called the 8 Precepts. And that's not giving anything away. But,
yeah, sure.
Wait, the Yakuza are real?
in this manga, they are.
I mean, the Yakuza are... definitely real. Yes, it's like
that's the joke.
The mafia,
yeah,
are real.
Yeah, yeah, just like the triad is real. Yes, Yakuza, okay. Listeners, thank you for listening.
I'm just gonna ignore Nick. I'm just gonna start muting you because, like, I don't know. Anyways, they're fighting against the Yakuza and their captains, a fictional version of them, and you know, you see all these new characters fighting and using their powers, and that's all really cool. But now it's our main character's time to shine, and it's amazing, and I can't wait to see what happens this week. So, My Hero Academia.
Hell yeah. Nick, what are you excited for this upcoming week?
First off, I want to say I think Renee needs to get his own little, like, manga, like manga corner sort of segment. We'll call it Shown and Tell.
Well done. So, well done, my friend.
Now that Renee's dead, yeah, so not much to say here. Aliens Dead Orbit number 4, it's supposed to come out this Tuesday. It might not. For those unaware, we got issue 3 all the way back in July. We've been waiting for this issue ever since. They say you can't rush quality, but I'm beginning to wonder if maybe we can at least just give it a little swift kick in the booty. But you know, it's James Stokoe. All you need to know is it's a beautiful book. If you haven't seen any of his other work, go check it out. It's only 4 issues. Get the trade when that rolls out. I think that's slated for March at this point. But if you like beautiful work, if you like just super meticulous, unbelievably detailed art, this is it. If you like aliens, this is perfect. I can't recommend this book enough. Dark Horse has really done a great job with this franchise. And it needs to be acknowledged. So that's pretty much it. Aliens Dead Orbit number 4.
I was going to pick this book, but I wanted to give you your choice because
you
want to
make me look like a fool when it gets delayed again. I think this has been my pick 2 other weeks and it hasn't come out. So, you know, I am become the new Tia, I suppose.
Well, for me this week, I'm excited for Iceman number 7. I almost said X-Men. This is an X-Men book. Cena Grace and Robert Gill on art. The old Champions group, which consists of like Hercules and Namor. I don't even know. This weird group. Ghost Rider, I think, is in this group.
That sounds right.
Someone. It's really bizarre. It's the old gang is back together, and they're fighting crime. And Bobby Drake, he doesn't know what to do because this is the last thing that he needed in his life. Like, he's still trying to figure out how to be this person that he now discovered that he is. And I think that adding this huge level of conflict on top of the story has been really good for Cena Grace to tie into this whole Marvel Legacy stuff that's happening. This is a really fun way to make that actually work, unlike some of the other X-Men books, which is a dumb crossover event with Mojo that I'm eating up the same way that you would eat a bag of cotton candy. You know that it's going to be bad for you, but you can't stop because there's still stuff in the bag. So Iceman is actually a nice potato to go along with the steak that is Generation X, if I had to put it all on the table. So that's the way, and we're not going to talk about Weapon X because that's in the trash because I decided that the rice didn't cook well and I didn't want to eat it. That's
we're just rolling.
What else
can
we say? I'm impressed. I get an X-Men corner as well. So that's what I'm excited for this upcoming week. I really love what Cena Grace is doing with this book. It's like between this and Jean Grey, we've got some good solo X-Men books for the first time in a long time, and I really appreciate that. Our show this week is a Goodreads Pick of the Month, where the podcast team picks a book that we want to read and we discuss it here on the show. So this month, we've decided to go with Batman the Long Halloween, seeing that Halloween is this upcoming Tuesday, the day before this episode drops, so it's extra spooky or something. We decided to read this book to not only take everyone's love of Batman, but also a love for very solid 13-issue book, graphic novel, whatever you want to call it, and discuss all the various pieces and parts of this book. So before we get started, I want to warn everyone, spoilers for all of Batman the Long Halloween. If you have not read that, stop listening to this podcast, go read the book, and come back and press play. But so let's get started. I guess there's a lot to unpack with this book. This is a story by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale. It's one of the most, in my head, iconic Batman stories in recent history. The one thing that I will say, everyone smokes in this fucking book, and that blew my mind that like everyone's just like pulling a cigarette like out of their ear, out of their back pocket, and just like, yeah, we're lighting up in the middle of this tiny closet that we're hanging out in. I'm in jail, and I'm smoking a cigarette. Like, what? Whatever. I don't know. Crazy stuff. There's a lot of stylized art, but I guess let's start with you, Renee. What are your thoughts on this book? I think the three of us had maybe read it once or twice or three times before, but we decided to take an in-depth look at it. What did you think of this book this time around?
I really love this book. I love Jeff Loeb as a writer, both his comics and the films that he's written. And also, I've actually met Jeff Loeb once, and it was seriously one of the best moments of my life. But yeah. I love Jeff Loeb as a writer, and and Tim Sale's art sells this story on every level, and I'm not even joking. Literally every single level, and it's fantastic. I think Batman: The Long Halloween is like Jeff Loeb's detective novel, because it reminds me of a very classic detective novel, and it's got everything. It's got all the tropes in it, and it's also fantastically realistic and also surreal at the same moment. And
right,
I think also just it's the right kind of creepy, and I guess I wouldn't say spooky, but I also find myself, you know, just sort of scared while reading it. And I think, but it's not like I'm scared for my life, but I'm thrilled at being terrified. About.
Yeah, it's a really intense book. Like it's a full suspense thriller all throughout with the big question mark of whodunit. So I guess before we, you know, dive into the various aspects of it, can we get like a summary of what this book actually is? Maybe Nick, you want to jump in here?
Sure. Yeah. So this book surrounds a series of killings that start happening in Gotham, and they tend to happen once a month. And they tend to happen on certain holidays. And of course, as the book is called, it begins on Halloween. And, well, who's being killed? Well, interestingly enough, all of the people that seem to be killed are all members of Carmine Falcone's gang, his mob. This is the mob boss. I think he was featured prominently in Batman Year One by Frank Miller. Mm-hmm. And this book is frequently seen as a follow-up to Year One because Archie Goodwin went to Frank and said, do you want to do anything more with this? And Frank said, no, man. I've got other things that I need to ruin. So, I mean, let me be honest. Thank God he was too busy or didn't want to do it, because I know we would have not gotten the same book in Frank's hands.
Sure.
So you have these murders that are happening month after month, and Commissioner James Gordon, District Attorney Harvey Dent, and Batman resolve that they're going to they're going to find and, you know, deal with this person who's now just simply being known as Holiday. And of course that involves trying to figure out who Holiday is, and a lot of this story really revolves around Harvey Dent before he becomes Two-Face. I know it's hard for people to believe, but roughly 20 years ago when this story was told, as far as I understand things, there weren't a lot of stories of pre-Two-Face Harvey Dent, which is what a lot of this story was meant to tell. And at the beginning of the book, you see Harvey more or less saying, well, you've got these mob people, and they're all being killed, and so what's the problem? It's sort of working itself out. And of course, Batman and Gordon are like, well, this is still murders gripping our city. Like, you know, I see your end. Yeah. I see your end justifies the means, you know, mentality, but that's not great. And so each issue of this arc, you know, captures a different month and a different killing, or maybe not. Things get interesting there as Batman and the group attempt to figure out who done it. And it's a real, real mystery of a tale for sure. But that's basically it. Serial killer named Holiday, killing roughly one person a month, all of Falcone's people. It's a mystery.
I think it's also worth mentioning that Gordon is not commissioner yet, but he's a captain.
Oh, yes. Right. I'm sorry. That's right. This is earlier. I forgot. Because this follows Year One, like Batman, I believe they said this is maybe like 2 years into Bruce being Batman. Give or take, I think they said two or three, which is interesting because you do get a Bruce Wayne and a Batman that's a little less self-confident, a little more prone to make mistakes, which I like. He's not the, like, sentient, you know, omniscient Batman that you sometimes get these days where it's like, I know everything, I can do everything, I figured out everything, I'm, like, 12 steps ahead of you. Like, that's not the Batman you get here, and I like that. You know, he doesn't have that confidence yet. And that's why you have all those things where he's saying, you know, I believe in Harvey Dent, or do I believe in Harvey Dent? Anyway. Yeah,
I love the first time that they say that in the book, because it's like, they show the three different perspectives of Batman, Gordon, and Dent, and I think like Gordon's like, I believe in Batman, and Batman's like, I might believe in, I don't even remember what he said, I don't think he picked a specific person, but someone else is like, I believe in Harvey Dent. But I just thought it was cool to see the three of them go through that same sort of what they believe in type thing.
Yeah, this is like I like the moment with the three of them where they make this pact that they're going to catch this person. And Gordon kind of leads the conversation in to Harvey Dent saying, so we have this guy, and then Batman shows up. And Dent almost isn't okay with him, I think, because he's outside of the law, even though Dent has this very black and white mentality, which obviously leads to the Two-Face thing. But together, they decide this is what's going to happen. And you see the three of them consistently come together, and you watch their relationships change based on how things progress throughout the book as the Holiday Killer begins to kill more and more and the suspect list gets narrowed down further and further. I really liked how at the end when it's just Batman and Gordon and they're talking and Gordon says, I think, Nick, you pointed this out in your notes, you know, Batman says, or Gordon says to Batman, how long did you know? And Batman says, like, he goes silent. Like, he's like, a long time. He knew that Harvey Dent was the killer. I mean, and there's a lot more to unpack about who was actually the killer in this. Mm-hmm. But that the fact that when the tides turn and then Batman and Gordon come back to this place that has been a common element throughout the book, I thought was really, really powerful to say, as soon as you're out of the club, you're way out of the club with these guys. I really like that. I don't know. It just, it was a really cool image, like a consistent thing as you read this in one long go like I did.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Like, I don't mean to like rush to the end of this book here. There were a lot of things that were really good about this book and things that were really powerful. So I don't know, Nick, let's cut back to you, Renee. Like, were there things that you were just like, hell yeah, this is kicking a lot of butt? Like, what really sold you on this story?
I, so many things, but the things that really stick out to me are actually have nothing to do with the mystery, although the mystery is absolutely fantastic. But I love the scene during Christmas when Joker is quoting the Grinch word
for word. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because, I mean, I love that moment, and just there's another moment, I think it's earlier in the story when Joker's beating up Harvey Dent, or maybe it's later, I think it's later. And Dent starts fighting him, and he's like, oh, you're good, but you're no Batman. I just think, because it shows that, you know, the Joker isn't just this insane person that's doing things willy-nilly, that he, while he is a person of chaos, he's also very meticulous, and he knows so many things, and also just, it's so creepy for him to be, like, turning this thing that you love, that you watch every year, into, oh my God, there's an intruder in my house who's going to kill me.
Right. Yeah, the Joker moments in this book I thought were really great. I mean, he got that moment of there can't be two crazy homicidal maniacs in this city. And so even the Joker is trying to find Holiday just because he can't stand
Joker's
it.
Joker's having a real like identity crisis as the story goes on. And Tim Sale's Joker is so instantly identifiable. He's like contorted and like he's got like sort of a contortionist frame and he's bow-legged all the time. And of course, his teeth are just
16 million teeth.
These weird, super angled, like it's definitely a very definitive appearance. And I like that Joker, you know, he's in this, but he's not an overwhelming presence. And like we said, like he's basically petty and insecure for most of this whole thing. Yeah. Like he's trying to figure it out too, because like he wants his place in the sun once more. So, and of course you do get, you know, every other villain under the sun as well. I think some certainly have a larger place than others. I thought it was interesting that we returned to Calendar Man more than a couple times, and for those who are unaware, I think we saw him in Tom King's Rebirth one shot that sort of kicked off the Rebirth run, which was an interesting character as well. For those who aren't aware, Calendar Man / Julian Day is one of the inmates at Arkham Asylum, and he is absolutely fixated and obsessed with dates and holidays, and, you know, if you're, you know, born here, then you're a Gemini, so he's obsessed with all the astrology stuff, too.
What a genius move on the part of the writers and whoever created Harvey Dent or whatever, whoever gave Harvey Dent his birthday to make him a Gemini.
Yep.
Like, what a subtle little thing to add to his character about being of two minds or being, you know, two souls in one. What a smart idea.
I do want to ask, and not to take things off the course too much, but do either of you genuinely believe that Julian Day actually had any insight into any of this, or do you think that was just a full-scale bluff when he continues to tell everybody who shows up? You know, he tells Batman a couple times, if you let me out, I think we can put this to bed. Do either of you believe
I thought he was bluffing whole time. I think same. The moment he brings up the idea that he's no longer relevant because Holiday is doing a better job than him, I think that's when he started to really push on the, hey, if you let me out of here, I can help you. Like, he wanted to be relevant again. He didn't want to be this forgotten, you know, rogues gallery character that just stays in Arkham and is no longer useful. I think he really was feeling the pressure of being bumped out of his slot. And I feel like that's a really fun element to play with, I think, as a writer. It must be really fun, I should say, because to play with this idea that these rogues gallery characters, they know they have a niche, they know they're this thing, and if anybody tries to challenge them on that, they take them out. Like, we've got the Joker being insecure, we've got the Riddler uncertain of himself, being able to predict whether and really like figure this riddle out. We've got Calendar Man, who's insecure about being bumped off of his big pedestal. And it goes even further, like Catwoman trying to figure things out and not being sure, and the whole Catwoman, Batwoman thing is, or Batman thing is a whole different part of the story, but But I think all of these Rogues Gallery characters have this problem, with the exception of maybe Solomon Grundy, who just wanted a Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah. He's relatively unfazed by the whole thing.
yeah.
But see, I have to disagree with Mike, actually, about Calendar Man. Because also, first of all, the Calendar Man parts are my favorite in this entire book. So I'm really glad that you brought this up, Nick. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, I think Calendar Man actually did know it. Because I think even starting in the first conversation, he refers to the holiday killer as both he and she in the way that he talks.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he continually does that. Renee. He does. everyone points out all the time it could be a woman, so...
I think there is still a part of it, though, that, like what Mike said, where he, he's taking my shtick, you know, screw that guy. But I think there's more to it than that. I think Calendar Man really did know more than Batman, and he sort of seemed like the omniscient one at the time, because he was like, I definitely know, but let me out of here. But at the same time, he was pressing so hard, specifically on Mother's Day, and Batman's like, everyone's got a mother, even you. And he's like, yeah, let me out. And to the point where it's like too much. Like, I think that he had other things that he wanted to do. But I think that Calendar Man really did have, like, he's one of those villains that has that genius that, you know, kind of, is on
when it
on
comes
par.
To dates.
Yeah, it's on par with Batman, because despite the fact that, you know, this is the holiday killer and it has to do with dates, he deduced that there was more than one killer and that it was both male and female.
Yeah,
that's true. With very little information. And, you know, despite the fact that he's got an odd shtick, you know, he's not Condiment Man, though. But, I mean, despite the fact that he's no so kite weird, man. He is still a brilliant man, and I would actually really love to see more people play with Calendar Man, especially since he's so damn creepy.
Right.
Like, I'm so unsettled whenever Calendar Man shows up, but I also really like that in the Batman story.
Yeah. Nick, what did you think? Did you think that there was some insight? It sounded like you said you agreed with me.
Yeah, I think for me, I felt like Calendar Man was just simply messing with Batman. You know, he says he uses, you know, both he and she. But also at that point, you've seen several of the characters in the story go back and forth on the idea that, well, it could be a woman if you look at the sort of gun that was used and the access to the, you know, makeshift silencers and everything. Like, this could be the work of a woman as well. So I just loved some of those pages with Calendar Man where it's, you just look into his room and it's this huge mess of just white sheets just like piling up and piling up. And there's this one page where Batman is walking away from Calendar Man, and on the front, on the top half of the page, it's just all of this white and all these white sheets. And on the bottom half, it's Batman walking away, and it's like these massive, like almost like unrealistic tendrils of his cape just pulling away from that half of the page. Yeah. And like that whole bottom half is just covered in black, and it was like this really interesting sort of dichotomy. But yeah,
it's one of my favorite pages.
it's so good. There are so many fantastic pages in this book. And I do want to say, yes, I'm sure there are some comic book readers out there that want to give this book a try, and they look at the art and it's not even like, oh, that's so 1997 art, because it really doesn't even fit that description of it's just, you know, it's art from the era and it's just inescapable. But it is hyper-stylized, and I know that there are some very bold design choices in terms of character design for a lot of the different characters that I know some people are probably going to find unsettling, but you know, stick with it and know that you're in the wrong, because this is great art, and... you know, just deal with it. It's so amazing, honestly. I don't know why we don't get more Tim Sale, but for those who are wondering, he does do the variant covers for Batman right now for the current mm-hmm. Rebirth run. If you get the variant covers, those are all Tim Sale, so if that's a selling point for you, great. If not, you know, whatever.
I think we should also give mad props to Gregory Wright for the coloring in this book.
Oh yeah,
because my god, as much as Tim Sale does with the art, Gregory Wright really does that final touch with the coloring, especially going from black and white to then hyper-stylized color and then just the way that he uses the shadows and the lights and based on the room and where they are, and just based on the moments, like all the murders are, I think, are in black and white, and then you go back to color. Yeah.
I was going to say one of the boldest choices of this book is when it relies on knowing not to use color or to use gradients or to use like grays, blacks, and whites for a lot of the different scenes. I was always impressed with just like, you know we want to strip it down here, especially for the pages where they would just desaturate the page except for like one little object on the page. Like this team's understanding of light in shadow is like unparalleled. Honestly, that's one of the best things I observed with this book. Like that final page during the epilogue with Gilda, where she's revealing what she knows. That's Harvey Dent's wife. And you see, like she's in the basement, right? She's in the basement of the house.
Yeah.
And you see from the upstairs, if you see from the upstairs, the door to upstairs has been opened, and it's painting this light as it goes through like the panes onto her face and like this really contorted, like misshapen pattern. And that was probably the most chilling page of the book for me.
Yeah, they did some really beautiful things with fire, I think. Firelight, yes, in this book, specifically at the Dent's house where they have the fireplace. There were some scenes that were just really powerful, and specifically at the end as well, as things are getting burned and stuff. I thought that the way they did the light from fire was just unparalleled. I don't think I've seen anything that was that like harsh and stark before.
Or like the boat scene where you think Alberto has killed himself and the whole page is desaturated, I think, except for just this little like wave of blood in the water off the side of the boat, and that's like the that's like the only thing you see. Absolutely the use of color and not just like having a broad palette and knowing, you know, what fits what, but this book's knowing when to not use color, I think, is one of its like great understated talents, honestly.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Renee. I forgot to write it down in the credits. That's totally my bad.
I love just the differences of the color, like especially like how we were talking about with the end of the book and then also the high power charge, but even just the courtroom scene where Dent becomes Two-Face, the fact that everything is colorized, everything's blown out so that it looks like you're in a daytime court session, you know, and then immediately jumps back into a different style. I think it's beyond words. I can't even talk.
Well, you're talking about the courtroom scene. Can we discuss the irony of being having acid thrown on you from an antacid bottle? I'm sure you guys caught that, but
I didn't even think of that.
I caught that, and I was like, "Oh my, yes, I love it, love it," and I also love that it's gangsters.
Explain the scene really quickly here.
So, gosh, you've got one mob boss, not the main one, but his name's Maroni. And he's going to basically go on trial and bury the Roman, a.k.a. Carmine Falcone. He's going to go on trial, he's going to testify, and they're going to put Carmine away for good. And as Maroni is going to trial, he meets up with his buddy, who basically also is a rat who works inside the district attorney's office, but who cares? And that guy hands him a bottle, which is presumed to be antacid because Maroni is constantly talking at least a couple times about how he has ulcer problems and stomach problems, which was smart because it really misdirects this scene pretty well, actually. He goes up and Harvey Dent, interrogates him and discusses things with him. And I don't remember what exactly sets him off. I don't know if you guys remember, but at that point, Maroni opens up this bottle and that's right. He says, you know, coughing. I'm sorry. My stomach or whatever is acting up. And he goes to take a sip from the bottle, processes it for a bit and then splashes it in Dent's face from the antacid bottle, and of course it's acid. Really, really well played scene. I honestly didn't remember it happening that soon or remembering it happening that way originally when I read the book. So
yeah. There was a lot of moments like that where I didn't remember the book the way that it happened. Like, I don't think I read this book since I originally bought it way back in 2007, maybe.
Yeah, it's been a few years.
It's been a while, and having read it now, I have a deeper appreciation for knowing more about Batman, right? And I think this is a good entry book for people that are trying to read cool Batman stories, but I also think if you know a lot about this world and the mythos behind the character, this book totally works. And it kicks so much ass because of all the little bits and pieces on top of the Rogues Gallery, and you get like all this background information. But I think like one of the final questions I have, you know, what did you guys think of the ending? What did you think of like the round off where we find out what actually happened? We get the mystery unraveled and the whodunit happens. We kind of touched on it earlier, but the big you know reveal is that there were what, three killers in total, right?
Three.
There were three people doing this. It was the first guy who was part of the mob, whose name I can't remember, he was the son of Falcone.
Alberto.
He was the son, yeah, sorry. It's the other, yeah. the guy who dies first is the nephew, that's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, so he was the good son that wanted, you know, this to get in the father's business, but his father was like, no, you go do non-mob things because, you know, you're a clean, innocent kid.
Oh, yeah, where have I heard that before?
Yeah. And, after he dies, the continuation is done by Harvey Dent's wife, we find out.
No, you actually got it flipped. You actually got it flipped. Gilda was first.
Oh, I got
first.
It flipped. Gilda,
right?
Okay, hold on.
Gilda
Nick
was first.
Explain this then. Maybe I tracked it wrong.
Gilda, it was Gilda up through, I want to say Christmas? It was Gilda up through Christmas. Then it was Alberto after he was dead, because that's the perfect foil, after he was seemingly dead. It was Alberto from there on until when Harvey Dent actually kills Carmine Falcone on the second Halloween, thus making him the final Halloween, final holiday. I can't wait to be wrong, but I think that's what it was.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's definitely Gilda first, because Gilda mentions that she realizes that Dent did a murder, and she's like, oh, we came to the same conclusion.
Right, she says, you came in with your hair was wet and everything, and I assumed that you had picked up the mantle at that point, which of course was hilarious, because she was wrong.
Right.
You know, he wasn't doing it at all, so.
So what did you guys think of it? I mean, like, I found it, and even in explaining it, it's a little convoluted to try to make the mystery work, but to think that this is all one person maybe is a little more insane, even for a comic book like this, without there being any sort of, like, real, like, I don't know, there was no MO, there was no thing that was inconsistent that could have proved that it was multiple people.
Sure.
And yet, it was multiple people, and they had the same MO. They left the smoking gun and an item representing the holiday.
And furthermore, none of
them
were working in collusion, and I think that's what makes it so interesting, is that seemingly, you know, first off, like you said, it's not just one person, it's multiple, and these people aren't even working together. It's basically copycat crimes. Basically, that's what holiday is it's a copycat act, more or less. And I like that it's smart. It's very unapologetically, like, guess what? Like, you need to pay attention. You really need to pay attention reading this book. We are not going to spell things out for you, except sort of at the end. So if you really haven't been paying attention, we'll try to save face. But it's smart, and it's definitely not dumbed down like you see in some Batman stories, where, like, is there a detective element? Yes. Is it really, you know, is it anything more than a simple, like, Googling? You know, not really.
What I found really interesting was that even at the end, you know, Batman and Gordon, they both kind of come to the conclusion that it's Harvey Dent, and Gordon asked Batman, which is what I was touching on earlier, how long did you know? And Batman apparently had this suspicion for a long time, even though it was wrong. The idea that Harvey was doing it the entire, not the entire time, but for most of the time, was something that he just assumed, when it turns out that it was his wife followed by Antonio. So, like, I thought that was interesting, and that the only damning thing for Harvey was that he killed Falcone at the end.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that, I mean, first off, yeah, that page is just amazing because you have Gordon just furious and he says, how long did you know? And you just have these three just final panels following that. One where Batman sort of just stares at him. And then the next one, he just looks away. And then Gordon basically like repeats the question, I think. And yeah, it's fascinating because you're right. By and large, up until that point, Harvey really hasn't done anything wrong, I think. I'm trying to reflect back.
Well, I mean, because obviously there's some... The thing is that you, after that panel, or I believe it's either right before or right after, we kind of get this reflection back on Harvey and all of these seemingly strange things that he had said or done, mm-hmm. like bringing the gun home.
Oh, yeah. Like, I bring evidence home all the time. It's normal.
Yeah, and he says, you know, the person that got shot was, you know, those were a bunch of nice people. Like, there's no sarcastic mark or italicized. He just says it, and it's interpreted by Batman as like, Harvey, that's a shitty thing to say.
Yeah.
Like, which I thought was funny. But, like, there are these all these moments where you kind of see Harvey saying, well, maybe that type of justice isn't wrong. And Batman and Gordon going, that, no, Harvey, it's wrong, dude. What are you thinking? And so they reflect back on that. But at the end, in the big reveal, you're kind of like, oh, maybe Harvey just had this mentality. He was rooting for this person, but he didn't actually want to commit it until everything was taken away from him, mm-hmm. Which was his face and his mentality, or sanity, I guess.
I really love that scene, and it really threw me for a loop towards the end because I couldn't figure out why. When you realize that Harvey has gone after he has escaped, and you have basically the Arrested Development scene of them at the hospital, and they're like, what happened to Harvey, as his wife says, and then the doctor goes, he's gone. You know, remember that from Arrested Development where,
oh, yeah.
You know,
oh,
no,
yeah.
No, literally, he's gone. And if he stabs a surgeon, which, like, rude. It disappears. It's so weird, honestly, because, like, I don't ever remember them being... I thought it was in other Two-Face stories, like, well, we tried to fix his face, but, I mean, what's the medical term for this? It's hardcore fucked up. Like, there's nothing we can do. I don't remember it being, right. Like, Harvey, like, they're in the middle of trying to fix him, and he's like, I'm out. Like, peace.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of odd. But you have Harvey, and he goes to Arkham Asylum, and he lets everyone out except for Calendar right. Man. and I'm like, yeah. why are we doing this? Like, what's the point? And he's basically showing Batman, like, this is what's going to happen. Like, every time, and he says that, like, every time you send these people back, this is what's going to happen. Every time. Like, this is how your system works. This is your, like, idea of fixing things. And as you can see, because I let them out, you know, it doesn't fix anything. It just, it's very interesting to see Harvey kind of casting, you know, as you see in other comics, you know, a real questioning of Batman's methodology and does this work or does it not work?
Right.
So,
Renee, what did you think about this whole thing? Really, Nick and I have just kind of been talking back and forth, so I'm sorry about that.
It's fine. The thing that made me think of, actually, the ending was it, and spoilers here for this movie that's coming out, it reminded me a lot of Mystery on the Orient Express, because I don't know if you guys have read that at all.
I haven't.
Okay, well, sorry to ruin this for you, but at the end of the novel...
sorry to ruin this, Christie, like, 80-year-old book for you, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, but yeah, it's also, yeah. It's a classic story, and, you know, but the at the end of the book, it's revealed that everyone that is a suspect in some way had something to deal with the murder, so they're technically all the murderers.
Oh, okay.
Because they all had some reason to kill the person, and they were all with him, and they all did something to him that eventually caused his death. So it while it's not exactly the same, it reminded me that there was more than one killer, and more than, and it's sort of like, you know, you're not entirely sure who killed who or why, and it sort of just left up in the air of the sort of right and wrong. And mm-hmm. I think Hercule Poirot, the detective for Mystery on the Orient Express, he says, you know, I'm satisfied with what I've done in the mystery, so it's up to you to decide what happens now. And I sort of, it's sort of like, it leaves a bitter taste in your mouth. You're kind of sad because you didn't solve it. You solved it, but you didn't solve it. And I think that same feeling is in at the end of this book. And because it's also just basically, it's a tragedy of what yeah. happens when you have too strong of a moral compass like Harvey Dent, or you see things in black and white. And, you know, Gilda just wanted more time with her husband. And Alberto just right. wanted the love of his father. And I think that it's important to show that when Carmine thought Alberto was dead and he was just all by himself by the body that he thought was his son, that he breaks down and there's no words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all of Carmine's kids just want his respect. And you know, in the end, none of them really get what they want. And so there's just a whole lot of bitterness in your mouth, but at the same time, it's told in such a way that you'll remember it for forever, you know?
And, like, yep. it's so awkward when Alberto's in jail, and he's like, yeah, I did all of them, and that was all me, and, like, he's, like, trying real hard to be a super, you know, tough guy, and it's like, I'm not buying it, you know, maybe a few of them, yeah. but, like, it's so sad, because you can see, like, that's him relishing what he thinks is, like, his new identity now, like, that's gonna be what finally gets him respect and everything. So, you know, like most stories, it turns into a psychology of daddy issues. So, I mean, what do you want? It's yeah. Batman. And I mean, you know, his.
And that also goes for, you know, Falcone's daughter, who I don't think we've mentioned much in the episode, because her character seems like she was injected into the story to add another layer of whodunit, you know, and ultimately, at the end of the day, it wasn't like a huge like thing for her to be in the story. Like, she ended up being just another muscle. So I mean, and there's some other elements I think we could have touched. I mean, we could touch on, but we are running super long. So let's wrap this up. I guess final thoughts on this book. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I think this is an absolute must for anyone who feels the need. And again, like, I'm not trying to gatekeep here. So this is optional. If you feel that you're one of those people that wants to read truly big instrumental Batman quote unquote classic stories, I think mm-hmm. this really belongs on that list. I think for most people, this needs to be in the top 10. For new readers, I actually think it's pretty new reader friendly. You do get to meet most of the members of the Rogues Gallery. For people that their large-scale introduction to Batman is through the Christopher Nolan films, obviously this is a great connection to that, yeah. because clearly
I didn't even bring the
rise
so
and fall
Nolan.
Of Harvey Dent. Yeah, I mean, Nolan even said, you know, his movie, The Dark Knight, is very clearly based off of The Long Halloween, because it really is this Harvey Dent-centric story. So I think it's a good read for new readers, those who are really drawn to unique or powerful or interesting art. I think there's something here for them. For those who are looking for creative redesigns and new takes on the Batman characters and the villains, I think there's something here for them. For those who just want a really good mystery, there's something there too. So it really offers up a lot. And for pretty much everyone, there's something here that they're going to really be able to enjoy, I would say.
Cool. Renee, what'd you think?
I love this book. I recommend it to pretty much anyone I know that has any interest in comics. And like I said, I think that this is Jeff Loeb's detective novel. I think that it stands alone as just a great mystery story. If you love detective stories, you absolutely need to read this. And even if you're not a fan of Batman, because it's grounded in this idea, this world of realism, by having it surround the mob, the local mob. And it even has mm-hmm. a lot of throwbacks to The Godfather, and has direct imitations of scenes from it. And I think that mm-hmm. if you like that kind of thing, you'll enjoy this, because it has a perfect blend of realism and surrealism, in that these things could happen if there was a vigilante trying to take down, like, you know, the mob. But at the same time, there's also Poison Ivy and Scarecrow and, you know, Calendar Man.
Yeah.
So I think it's a perfect blend of weird and reality, and I think that it's something that people will enjoy, even if they don't think that they will. And I think that it's also one of my favorite stories, because it's a Batman story that's kind of haunting. It doesn't fill you with fear, but it does fill you with all kinds of emotion that it's you're not going to forget for a while. And I think that that's something that's been missing in a lot of the recent Batman stories.
Yeah, solid. That's true. Yeah, when you're done, like, you're like, you feel like, well, the case was solved, but I feel terrible.
Yeah. And also, really, I feel like there's the way that Batman's portrayed is he's pretty scary a couple of times. Like, even with the way that his cape is drawn with the tendrils. Like, Batman, when I was a kid, Batman scared the hell out of me. And, like, right. Now I feel like, you know, only criminals in the story are scared of Batman, but at the same time, what's not scary about a 6-foot man dressed as a bat beating the shit out of you?
Right, right. My final thoughts on this book are there's so much to unpack. I think that it's unfortunate that we only have so much time to do this show about this specific book, because, you know, we didn't touch on a lot of different things, and it's such a solid book. It's a page turner. Like, it's one of those books that's really hard to put down. I would dare you to try to read this book in multiple sittings. I think it's impossible because it's such a fast-paced book in a lot of ways. Like, the pacing changes per issue, but you're driven to keep going because you want to find out more about this whodunit story. So yeah, I think I'm in the same boat as Renee. I would recommend this to anyone who wants to get into Batman books, who wants like a really solid Rogues Gallery book that isn't just, you know, oh no, the Joker's on the loose. Instead, it's got the thrills of a detective story. It's got the thrills of a Batman story. It's got everything that you would want in a solid detective comics story. And I highly recommend it. That's probably the least I could say about it, if anything. But yeah, this is such a solid read. It's long, and it's a nice hefty book to carry around, and it's totally fantastic. So let's wrap this show up here. Let's do a little bit of credits. Where can people find you guys on the internet? Let's start with you, Renee.
They can find me on the Twitter at Rodriguer29. Yeah, if you ever want to talk to me about comics or manga, feel free to do so.
Yeah, Ping Renee, he knows everything there is to know about manga, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, let's not
Nick, where can people find you on the internet?
Sure, you can find me at Death Star Plans on Twitter.
Yeah, it's all spelled out in the show notes. It's real fun. You can find me on Twitter at Mike Rappin. You can also find me on Medium at Mike Rappin, where I will start to write X-Men articles. I promise someday. Renee, I owe you at least 4 at this point.
Yeah, you do.
Finally, you can also follow the show at IRCB Podcast, where we retweet stuff and we post polls every Friday. And yeah, we try to talk about comic books as much as we can on that account. So send us a message, send us a tweet about what you did or didn't like about this episode, and I will get back to you with all sorts of gifts and funny things, I guess. I'll try to be funny at least.
Well, if Twitter isn't your thing, or you find yourself wanting more exposure to us, go figure, than Twitter, you should go check out our Goodreads group. In fact, it's the whole reason that this show exists in the first place. So our book club, we have two book clubs currently running. We have the one where the members of the podcast pick the book, and then we also have one where all of the people at Goodreads vote on the book, and they pick a book, and that's discussed there as well. So if you want to get in on those discussions, you're more than welcome to. We also have places where you can talk about comic books and current TV and current movies. You can talk about the books that you're reading or the things that you're interested in. We also have interviews, or not really interviews, but we have places where you can talk with actual comic book creators, the most recent being with Matt Horak, the artist who just, what is that, Mike? His last issue has yet to come out, is that correct?
His last issue just came out, actually.
Just came out, I'm sorry, just Punisher. Came out. Of the Punisher. So, we have a place for that. Other than that, feel free to check us out at ircbpodcast.com, a very useful resource if you want to see our weekly pull list document and see the books we're reading, as well as just another way to get your hands on the podcast if that's how you choose to do it.
We also have our pronunciation guide on our website for how to pronounce various comic book creators' names, and you know, there are some tough ones out there, and we're trying to help people with that, so that's also there.
Please rate, subscribe, and tell your friends about the podcast if you enjoy it. And also, don't forget to mention that we have a Kickstarter going, and we really appreciate everyone that has contributed to that. And just thank you for your time for listening to us about that. You can also email the show at irstv@destroythesod.org. Please reach out to us. We love talking to you. Seriously, I'm not just saying that. We actually enjoy talking to you. So, and also, Mike might be a little bit lonely, so feel free to talk to him anytime.
Yeah, send me emails that are just like, hey, winky face, and then we'll have a dialogue. Infinity Shred does all the music for our show. They're the absolute best and the nicest guys in the world. Go check out their music on Bandcamp or on their website, infinityshred.com. Xander, he's just a very nice person. He also edits the show, and I really like that guy a lot. I think you guys like him too. Finally, I want to say thank you to everyone for listening to the show. Thank you, Nick and Renee, for being on the show. This was an awesome discussion. I love talking about comic books with you guys. Just having a whole episode to do that like warms my heart to no end. So thank you so much for being here, and thank you, listeners, for everything you do, everything you talk about stuff with us online, favorite our tweets and retweet things and share everything. Thank you so much. So until next time, we will check you later. Yes, Nick, we absolutely did forget to go through some Goodreads comments, and I don't want to leave anybody out because otherwise, what's the point? Now, I do like having conversations with people on the Goodreads group, but we do owe them the honor of being mentioned on the show. So let me start with a comment from Chris. He said he was captivated by the mystery surrounding Holiday. He's been a fan of comics and comic culture his whole life, so he's been accustomed to the tropes and cliches that oftentimes hinders a story. When I saw that the Long Halloween was a mystery, I figured that I'd be able to crack the mystery fairly easily. For comics, in his experience, have not been the best at pulling off well-told mysteries, and I was not able to deduce who the character was before the end of the story. But in this case, I was highly impressed by how the mystery unfolded. I won't say what happened, but it was well handled and quite surprising to me, at least. We already spoiled it, so it's okay. Thank you for your comment, Chris. I think you hold to the same feelings that we all do about this book, or at least that I did.
Here's an interesting one from Hansen. He writes, as a longtime Batman fan, this was always required reading from every source I encountered, and to be plainly honest, I avoided it for years because of a lack of appreciation for Tim Sale's art. Now that I am older, a comic book store clerk, and an artist, I've not only come to enjoy the art, but ended up defending Sale's art regularly. While it certainly is a required taste, the pairing of Loeb's story to Sale's art is eerily perfect. Yeah, I think Hansen's spot on. I think we've discussed this a little bit earlier. I pointed out that I know there are people out there who either just see the art and just won't even give the book a try, which is a real tragedy, or they actually decide that they're going to get into the book and just still can't put up with it. And I think for some people, it just needs to grow on you a little bit. It is like an aesthetic that as you see more of the world and just sort of this bigger just wholesale aesthetic that it is, I think it's a little bit easier to take on. But it is jarring for some people, definitely.
Yeah.
I have this interesting one by Daniel, who comments, like, I love this comment. He says, I cannot imagine having to read this month to month. I would have gone crazy. And I have to agree. I can't imagine what that would have been like.
That makes me want to cry.
We've talked before on the show about books that would be nearly impossible to read in singles, and yes, this one in singles would break my brain, honestly.
I think it, also in his comment, he said, I had no idea how much this inspired Nolan's The Dark Knight. I felt the exact same way. I didn't realize actually how much Christopher Nolan pulled out of this book into his movie. Seeing that I hadn't read it since I first bought it, and I didn't even make the connection then, I'm really blown away by how much The Dark Knight actually pulled out of this book.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. It's especially the whole cash thing, I think, is like the most memorable one. But there's so many other like little things that were taken, and I think it's great.
Yeah.
I also love Daniel's final thought. He says, this book is a great representation as to why Batman's Rogue Gallery is the best. Everyone serves a purpose to drive the story forward. And I think that is Daniel, I love your brain. Yes.
Okay, let's do one more quick comment. I just want to call this last one out because I'm very happy that it exists. This is from Anthony, He did write okay to air at the end of his comment, so I didn't have a heart attack. But he says, this is the second time I've read The Long Halloween. Thanks to your podcaster's pick, I found a book that I was interested enough to join a discussion. Great pick. This also gave me an excuse to buy the digital version of the book. This time around, I read the book virtually in one sitting. Now, this isn't about the book. I'm mostly just excited that we gave someone a reason to come out and comment on the Goodreads group. That's so fucking awesome to hear. So, Anthony, please come back. Please keep reading and commenting and stuff. We love everybody. Thank you to Kate, Anthony, Kate again, Daniel, Hansen, Chris, and Kate Scotches, who's on the show as well, for commenting and posting in this Goodreads group. Sorry we didn't get to the comments in the middle of the discussion. I was just very excited to get into it. So thank you, everyone. We will we'll check you next time. All right, we'll call it there then.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think you could have called it with the X-Men corner.
Yeah, maybe.
I love cool. That you kept going with the food analogy.
Roll with it, baby. That's what I do.
Yeah. First, I was like, dude, do they sell bags of cotton candy? I have no idea.
Yeah, man, yeah. Have you ever been to the carnival? Fair? Yeah.
No, I went to swap meets and they had churros and like things there.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, churros. Same deal. Like, imagine you had 9 churros. Do you need 9 churros? No.
Yes.
Are you going to eat them all?
Yes.
Hell yes, you are.
I actually had a churro for the first time in, like, years the other day, and it was excellent.
That's fantastic. I don't think I've ever had a churro before.
I don't think I have either. Yeah.
Missing out. Yeah. Missing out, bro.
I know. Kelly is just reminding me. They sell them on the subway.
Yeah.
I could get one. I, like, can get off the subway at some stops, and there would just be a person there selling churros that you can buy 2 for $1 or something.
Yeah, you should do that. You should do that. Or if you find the elote man, or if you see a man selling tamales, always grab them off the vendor carts. Always.
Okay. Mangoes.
I mean, pay for them.
Jesus. Mangoes are also really good if you buy them from the street corner people. It's pretty great.